the theme tonight is relinquishment. Obviously not so popular theme. But this theme, relinquishment, this is actually my translation of the Pali word nekama. And there's, even though there's a little bit of doubt about the origin or the derivation of this word, but it seems that in the Buddhist scriptures that it seems to be used as a basis or the opposite of a word called kamma. It's not karma, not the Pali word for kamma, but kamma, which means sense desires, sensuality, to do with the senses. So nekamma literally means without sense desires. And that's a very fundamental or kind of very core teaching of the Buddha. And of course it's emphasized the importance of meditation because we do have senses. So it's not a matter of just kind of closing our eyes and ears and nose and mouth and being enlightened. We have to learn how to live in the sensory world but without being attached to it. And there's various ways in which the this is presented in the Buddhist scriptures. First of all, since the Buddha was a meditator, then he realized, as most of us do, that if you do have, you know, lots of sensory input, for example, it's a bit of a distraction, isn't it? Primarily, the most references to the sense realm are to do with the five senses. That's the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, the five senses. In Buddhism, the mind is the sixth sense. But when it talks about sensuality, it's mostly referring to these other, the physical senses. You know, physical senses and senses, sensation, sensuality. Although, in our Western society, it would be quite useful to also give some special attention to the sense realm as it relates to our mind. As most of us get quite a bit of stimulation, sense stimulation, from your mind. Yeah. Maybe not too much smell these days, especially in the winter. Your nose is all clogged up anyway. Maybe not too much taste, at least after midday in the monastery. Now there's quite a bit of a physical sensation with the cold weather. You know? And then, of course, sight. I mean, most people spend a lot of energy with seeing. That's probably the primary sense organ for most people. And then there's hearing also. It's quite important. In fact, I understand that the hearing is the most, is the last sense to go when one is dying. One can still hear because it's very passive. With seeing, you have your eyes open and maybe you have to actually look at things, but with hearing, your ears are open all the time. So you're absorbing. And then with smell, you maybe have to actually make an effort to smell something or taste, touch, but the ears are open all the time, so you're hearing constantly. So the nekamma literally means to be without sense desire, or more like without sensuality, because there is, you know, without sense desire is actually, you know, another synonym, I guess you'd say, for somebody who's enlightened. Or at least at the third stage of awakening, the non-returner, they have transcended desires, sense desires. But if we maybe become too idealistic about it or take it too kind of literally, then the only alternative for most people is just not to sense. Huh? How to get rid of sense desires, just don't sense then. But, you know, the fully enlightened being had the senses still. The senses were still active. The difference was they weren't attached to them. They weren't confused. They weren't addicted. They weren't deluded by the senses. The Buddha still could see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, but he had a different relationship to these senses than most of us. So the first level, I guess, if you like, the Buddha as a meditator realized that sense desires and sensuality is a great distraction for mental calm and meditation. That's why most of the images and most of the instructions, the images of the Buddha with his eyes closed, is his eyes closed? Not in this one, huh? But the image of meditation, you sit with your eyes closed in a quiet place without any food in your mouth. Maybe you're allowed to have a little bit of incense burning, you know. And a reasonably comfortable place. I mean, if you're in Southeast Asia, you've got mosquitoes buzzing around and ants crawling all over you, but but generally it's an initial phase or initial development of meditation. It's encouraged to have some removal from sensory distraction or sensory stimulation. If not complete removal, at least you tone them down, because it's going to stir up the mind. And if we're working at the mind primarily in meditation, then to have a quiet mind means, you know, it's helpful not to have it stirred up all the time. But there's much more to it than that, because the Buddha realized that sense desire or sensuality is one of the great fuels for rebirth. So this whole realm of a change now from not just sense desire, but of course sense desire is the primary object of the topic of greed. Greed is one of the sources of unskillful action, driven by greed. So if you remember from last Rain's retreat talks, greed was one of the hindrances, one of the five hindrances to, first of all, meditation, and then to spiritual development. But it's also, you know, sense desire specifically is mentioned as one of the sources of craving. It's one of the clingings, upadana. It's one of the outflows of personality, of self, the asavas. It's also one of the longings. It's also one of the floods. It comes in many different forms or different categories within the Buddha's teachings. And it's always the first one, you know, kind of primary one. Because, you know, we have a human being by definition, or you can say by nature, has the senses. We have them. So in a way it's a little bit of a paradox how to live with senses, you know, and, you know, one aspect of meditation is to even become more sensitive, if you like, you know, more aware of what you're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But the key to it is, you know, what is underlying it all is that to be able to understand this process, the sense process. And if we just, for example, just for a little while, just step away from sensuality, you know, something which is very stimulating, just to go back to the very nature of sense objects and sense organ, the whole area of being able to sense reality. It's not always sensual, is it? Well, you can say maybe in a negative way, it's also sensually painful as well as pleasant. Of course, what attracts us is the pleasant, the pleasure, the happiness, the joy, the pleasure. Even, you could say, you know, there's even some kind of sense of not only happiness and contentment, but even security. You know, if you're a bit confused, you look at some kind of object, and you get some sense of orientation and security, and oh yes, right, yeah, here I am. Identification, in other words. And that's where the Buddha's pointing at this whole realm of this is where the whole sense of self actually comes from. You know, there is an I, You know, physical I, okay? A physical I, then there's an object, then there is the seeing of it. There is a bit of a technical term in the Buddhist psychology called contact. That means there needs to be the sense organ, the sense object, and the consciousness. These three of them have to come together before there is a contact. And from the contact, which is literally, there needs to be a contact, that these three things are contacted together, and you have a consciousness. And from a consciousness, then there's a feeling, there's interpretation, there's thinking about it, there's all kinds of mental activity around that particular experience then. So, for example, we have an eye, a physical eye, for example, but if it doesn't meet an object, you know, if I'm not looking at the Buddha image right now, it doesn't exist for me, does it? It doesn't exist. I have to ask somebody, is it still there? You know? I'm not conscious of it, you know, unless I go into my mind, into memory now, and remember, oh yes, there should be a Buddha image there. So I remember seeing it before, physically. But right now I can't see it. So it doesn't exist. I still have my physical eye, but there's no object, say the Buddha image, to focus on. So there's no consciousness of Buddha image right now. There is, because it's memory. It's mental consciousness, not physical eye consciousness right now. But for you it is. If you look at it, then there is the eye consciousness now of image, Buddha image. And then may stir up, right? You see that, and then maybe it brings up a feeling tone that look feel pleasant. Well, some people might get a pleasant feeling about it and say, oh, it looks so peaceful. And they say, well, it's just a big black object. You know. You've got long ears, it looks a bit funny, maybe he's then he stirs up thinking and all kinds of things, maybe memories. You know, probably if you grew up in a Buddhist country, you looked at the Buddha image and it brings up all these memories. You know, I remember many people saying to me, you know, people from Buddhist countries, how many of them went to the temple when they're young children. Their grandmother or their parents took them there to the temple, and they saw this Buddha, big Buddha image, and you know, and they were very young and innocent, and you can imagine the awe coming into a temple and seeing this. Usually, they're golden images, this big golden image there. You'd just be awestruck, you know. And they come back to the temple, and they still have those associated memories, maybe not direct memories, but associated memories. I remember at the monastery in England, there we had full moon and new moon, we had an all night meditation. And it's somewhat similar. The monks sit in front of the Buddha image, and then the lay people sit facing the Buddha image. And one night about midnight or something, I was sitting there trying to meditate, trying to stay awake, kind of dozing off. And then I heard the door open, and I looked up, and there is this Thai man who used to come sometimes. And he came from London, middle of the night, midnight he got there. And he came in and he sat down right in front of the Buddha image. And I was watching him when he came in, and his eyes were on the Buddha image all the time. And he just sat down. And he sat there for 5 hours staring at the Buddha image. That maybe was his meditation object. He wasn't using breathing as a meditation object. He's using the Buddha image. You know, brings up all these associations and all these positive states of mind, perhaps. And you know, maybe he was actually reflecting upon, like, some of the chanting we do. The chanting about the recollection of the Buddha. The Buddha is the fully awakened one, the teacher of gods and human beings. And he thought of all these, reflected in his mind, these positive images. And he was in sort of an ecstasy, maybe. And he could just sit there for 5 hours blissed out. I couldn't sit there, maybe because I wasn't looking at the Buddha image, that was it. I had my back to the Buddha, that was why I couldn't stay awake. Now I realize the problem. Maybe I should turn around. But we have these sense impressions anyway. And with the sense impressions, then there is usually, for most people who are unaware of the whole process, there's these sense impressions, and then there's feeling tones, and then there is the associations, and then there's the desire arises. I want to keep that. I want to keep that, either that that mood, a state of mind. I want to keep that feeling, or I want to preserve that image. We think that that impression is the cause of our happiness. So we want to hold on to it. And the next time we come along and we look at the same image, we're in a different mood. And hey, what happened? Yeah. The Buddha's in a bad mood. Oh. Or somebody's changed the image or something, you know. The vibe is not giving off the proper vibes anymore. Yeah. But what has changed is your mind. Your attitude, your mood has changed. So we begin to recognize that these sense impressions are very, very unreliable. You know, for some people, they, you know, that's their, they can't see beyond that. You know, their whole realm, their whole world is based upon having these sense impressions all the time. They want to see beautiful sights, smells, tastes, touch, and have beautiful physical sensations. That's what the realm and their whole world is. That's what they call the human realm, I guess. And they don't realize that, you know, that these sensations, these impressions are very, very fragile, very impermanent, very unreliable, uncertain. And if you don't know anything beyond that, then we're sort of limited by that. In the Buddha's teachings, they talk about three different, literally, worlds. Three different realms of existence. And the first, the basic one, is the sensory realm. We were all familiar with. You know, I mean, some people, maybe they aren't even aware of that to a complete degree. Their impressions or their own disposition tendencies choose certain aspects of the sensory realm. You know, for example, when we sit here, I mean, can you really receive how the body is beyond pleasure and pain? Yeah, if you happen to sit down and you're like, oh God, there's that sore knee again. Ooh, you know, look somewhere else or do something else, or maybe I better sit in a chair or how to relieve it. Yeah. Can I really be open to it? You know, that is a sense impression, but we have a preference, don't we? And we all have a little bit of a bias. I mean, just the pleasure is a very positive experience for people. And if you notice the kind of response or reaction we have with pleasure and pain, for example, when there is pleasure from different sense impressions, you know, I don't know about you, but you know, I feel warm and relaxed, and it's very comforting and reassuring, and oh yes, I feel good. I know that I would. So it's very. I mean, it's worth coming again, isn't it? It's worth trying to relive that, you know. But if I sit and then oh, pain again. Oh, pain, pain, pain. I mean, you either got to be a masochist, you know, or you got to have, I don't know, some good meditation to be able to actually relate to this unpleasant or you know, this unhappiness or displeasure or discomfort every time. You know, we are pleasure seeking beings. I mean all sentient beings are pleasure seeking beings, not just humans. You know, every sentient being. I'm sure mosquitoes, you know, they're just driven by pleasure. You know, I haven't talked to one recently, but they always go around the warm. Apparently, they like warmth. I remember putting down a cup of hot tea one time, and a mosquito went to it. You know? I don't think it was an English mosquito looking for tea. I think it was going to the warmth, apparently. That's why some people they seem to get overwhelmed by mosquitoes all the time. See, people who have a little bit of a hot temperament, maybe, you know. Or what happens is they start squatting the mosquitoes and the body heats up and the more mosquitoes come. And they get they can just be cool. Mosquitoes would go away and look for a warm place, you see. But we have these senses, you know, and the Buddha's way, what it literally means, what is the escape from that? What is the way out? Is to understand the whole process. Understand these senses. So one of the themes of the foundations of mindfulness, or the themes of awareness, developing awareness, is around sense, the whole sense realm. Being able to understand the senses, the sense objects, and the consciousness that arises from it. It's not a matter of just saying, okay, you know, the sense desire is a baddie in Buddhism, we gotta get rid of it. Because the Buddha realized that this attitude is kind of literally, it's in its extreme, is called self-mortification, where one tries to suppress or repress or blot out sensuality through self-torture, mortification, deprivation. But the Buddha said that's one extreme. It's not going to lead to awakening. It's not the middle way. And maybe it is based upon a lot of ego. You know, I'm trying to get rid of my sense desire. I'm trying to conquer it. I'm trying to force it. You know, overcome it somehow. And this could be a source of great pride and maybe even ego, increase our ego then. I'm in control of myself now. Where if we understand the principle, we see how unreliable these sense impressions are, then our interest in them begins to fade. Our obsessiveness with them, our dependence upon them begins to fade away. Because we know, hey, this is not worth investing in, this whole realm of sensuality. Not worth investing in because it's disappointing me all the time. So one kind of removes one's interest in it and becomes more dispassionate, if you like. Or more of a technical term, but one I think very, very important in the Buddhist teachings is a term called disenchantment. When one actually sees the insecurity, the changeableness, the unreliability of these sense impressions, one gets disenchanted. And if I go back to the meditation practice, formally speaking, you know, first of all, developing calm meditation, it's helpful to be able to at least remove oneself to a certain degree from sensory distractions. Not only does it stir up the senses and the mind, you know, but it's hard to keep a focused attention then. You know, there's smells coming in and thoughts and memories and these things coming in. Hard to keep your mind focused on the breathing, for example. But then the next level of developing concentration is into what they call the meditative absorptions. One can get absorbed upon the meditation object. And in order to do that, then the sense impressions need to be at least temporarily suspended. One needs to be able to put them aside or remove one's attention from them to get more deeper levels of concentration. And this is the second realm of existence called the fine material realm. In the Buddha's teachings, there's a sensory realm, the fine material realm, and there's the immaterial realm. And basically speaking, one can only access these higher levels through meditation, through the jhanas. You know, there's the, like using breathing, as breathing is can be a fine material object to focus on. And when one develops this focusing attention on the breathing for some period of time with some energy and some commitment, then one's senses are removed from the sensory world, at least temporarily. The problem is, of course, one can't stay there all the time. Needs to come back to the sensory realm again. But at least it does, one is able to experience the possibility that there is another realm of existence beyond just the sensory realm, beyond being bombarded by sensory stimulation, which can stirs up the mind, and you can maybe recognize sometimes, especially when sensuality has been stirred up, the mind is quite coarse. You know, there's lust, there's anger, there's many of these very strong emotions. You know, in one of the scriptures, the Buddha gives quite a long list of different types of behavior which are stirred up by sensuality. He even goes so far to say that that's how wars start, you know, through sensuality. You know, you took away my beautiful sight. You know? You took away my beautiful sounds, I'm going to war. You took away my beautiful forest, you know, you invaded that land or something. And the way people get these very strong emotions rising up from sensory stimulation, because they've invested a lot in it, having, you know, on one level, at a kind of primal level, we need a certain amount of pleasure. And the Buddha allows this through the realm of meditation practice. When one can remove one's attention from the kind of coarse sensory realm, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and maybe thought to a certain degree, some kind of thought, and can experience deeper levels of concentration, absorption, and in that there is a different kind of peace. There's a great bliss comes out of it when the mind is really absorbed on a meditation object, away from the sensory realm. A great sense of bliss and peace arises. You know, this is what apparently the story of the Buddha was, that when he was very young, he was as a son of a very important person in the tribe. He was out, his father was doing some kind of ceremony or something, and he was left under this tree, the shade tree, all by himself. So he sat there as a young child, and he just entered kind of spontaneously this experience of absorption, bliss. Got self-absorbed, if you like, just quite spontaneously. And he had this ecstatic feeling of oneness with the universe. And then his father came along and said, "Hey, son, wake up." And then years later, when he's meditating, after trying all this self-mortification, which was the prevailing, I guess, one of the prevailing religious practices of the time, you know, you fast and you torture the body, sit out in the sunshine and get cooked, and you go into the cold and a lot of deprivations. Of course, it just dulls the senses. It doesn't turn them off. He tried that and didn't find much success, and he remembered this occasion, sitting under the tree in this bliss. And it wasn't based upon a material sensory stimulation. You know, he could have maybe sat there and you know, looked at the birds and kind of even blissed out on the birds sometime too, huh? and the flowers and, you know, the beautiful smell of what smells beautiful? The incense burning, mango flowers in the springtime or something or other. He could have blissed out on that, right? But he got self-absorbed. He closed his eyes and just absorbed into his breathing or something or other. And he had a different level of bliss then, of pleasure, and based upon concentration, deep absorption. He realized, he thought, maybe that's the way then. And he reflected, okay, this is not dependent upon these five senses anyway. It is dependent upon the mental sense to some degree. One needs to be able to focus the attention, so the mind is still active, but it's not being dependent upon the physical sensations, the beautiful sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch. It was a different kind, different realm of bliss, if you like. So he thought, oh, maybe that's the way then. So then he developed that kind of meditation, and the mind got in deeper levels of calm, and then he could use that deeper level of calm, which was independent of sensory stimulation, as a foundation for reflection, deeper reflection upon the nature of reality. In other words, if we're still dependent upon the sensory realm, we're not going to be able to penetrate any deeper. The Buddha is saying there's three different realms of existence: sensory, fine material, and immaterial realm. And if we're still dependent upon them in the sensory realm, even though the non-material realm is here, we aren't able to tune into it, aren't able to experience it. So like we're kind of one-dimensional then, see? Yeah, that's a good theme, isn't it? We aren't three-dimensional anymore. Because we're going to wear the three realms, you see. We're one-dimensional, just on the sense realm, see. Of course, there is, you know, the precepts are giving us guidelines. That was last week's theme, sila, precepts. Skillful behavior gives us certain guidelines to help us from getting too caught up with the sensory realm. You know, refraining from following these strong urges or these strong emotions of aggression and possessiveness and sensuality, lust, and lying, intoxication. Yeah. But really, the foundation behind it all is to understand this whole process. Just to follow it out of fear or out of some belief system is quite limited. You know, because sometimes our belief system or our fear states of mind, maybe they aren't there sometimes. You know, if you recognize there is something which you should stay away from. You know, some dangerous situation, some kind of situation which may be very tempting. You know, if I walk into the restaurant after midday, you see, and smell all these tempting smells, maybe I get tempted to eat supper in the evening, you see. But one time when I was in early years in Thailand, before I was a monk, I was staying in the monastery, and in the monastery there isn't any food in the evening. But one time some people came and they brought a whole bunch of food just after the monks had eaten. And so the monk who I was staying with, who lived upstairs actually, he brought some of this chicken, I think it was. He brought it to me. And I was a layperson, so I didn't have these precepts that he had. And he said, "Oh, they gave us all this food, but I can't eat it. You eat it. It's for you." So I was already full, so I put it aside. So in the evening, I started eating it. And I've never been so sick in my life. I hadn't eaten food in the evening for months. Okay? And then here was this chicken, no rice or anything, just chicken. And it was tasty, so I must have gorged myself, I guess. But then I got really sick, so it put me off having supper. Surprising what you can get used to, you know. But if one has these temptations, for example, maybe, you know, to transgress one's standard of behavior, and if one doesn't really understand the whole principle of cause and the effect, that okay, yes, it is pleasurable short term, you know, like this chicken was very tasty, you know, short term, but the long term effect was sickness. If we don't really see that principle directly, then we're just holding ourselves in through fear or loyalty to a system of belief or something. There's no wisdom in that, really. And that's why the Buddha is saying to be aware of the whole principle of the cause and effect relationship within the sensory realm. If you recognize that, oh, I've been disappointed so often by these beautiful sights and smells and taste and touch, you know, that it's let me down, disappointed me. I mean, if you really can open to that, really, really tune into it, you know, at a more subtler level, not just at a belief level, but a subtler level in meditation, for example, then you just, you kind of recoil from it. You withdraw your investment in it, your dependence upon it, your interest in it, and this kind of disenchantment sets in. And then one begins to really appreciate that peace that can come from the freedom or the independence from the sensory realm. You don't need to depend upon all these senses for pleasure. One can close one's eyes and one can be in a quiet place and experience a deeper level of peace of mind. Yeah. It takes a bit of an experience of that first, of course, for us to really appreciate these more subtler levels. I won't be able to explain the non-material realm because we're because we're in the material realm, the fine material realm. But there are meditations on the immaterial realm, like infinite consciousness. Can you imagine? If you are aware of some of the, say the mind is more quiet, and being able to observe the breathing more directly, more experientially, then you may notice that there's still a little bit of level, there's just a little level of discomfort there. It's not completely, you still have a body, for example, still some awareness of bodily sensation. Breathing is a sensation we're aware of. And sometimes the breath is a little bit not so smooth, perhaps, and it is, there is still a little bit of ripple in our consciousness, in our mind. If you recognize that, well, behind that, there is the immaterial realm. Can you imagine how subtle that is? When there's no breath anymore. Can you imagine? No breath. Anyway, don't think about it too much. Don't hold your breath. But sometimes, I don't know about you, but I mean, if I'm listening for something, for example, I hold my breath. And the breath is a bit coarse then. The breathing is there. If I'm aware of the breathing, then I don't hear the sound. So if there is that, recognize there is that bit of coarseness to that. I mean, it's very subtle compared to the bombardment of sensory impressions, walking down Cuba Street. Maybe you can maintain your samadhi, I don't know, but... I had to wait in Courtney Place the other day for the bus to the airport. And it was cold, and there were some very interesting signs across the street. Then when I was waiting there, standing there waiting, trying to keep warm, I turned around. There's all these little kind of images from Lord of the Rings, all these little Lord of the Rings monsters, in this shop next to me. They got the whole armies there, little plastic images. So then I got fascinated by that for a while. Oops, I missed the bus. Back to the waiting, standing in the cold, waiting for the bus again. But the Buddha is pointing out. I mean, maybe in a very unsophisticated spiritual practice, the Buddha might have just said, "Oh, don't see any evil, don't hear any evil, But the Buddha realized that it's not a matter of just turning it off. It's a matter of understanding this process to have some wisdom, how to relate to the world skillfully. Yeah. So the Buddha could still walk around in the world. He still saw, and smelled, and heard, and tasted, and touched, and thought. And so could function in the world, but he wasn't. He wasn't addicted to it. He wasn't attached to it because he realized, hey, this is only one passing realm. These sights, even though they are attractive and, one level, the Buddha did say, for example, it'd be for the practice of meditation, it's helpful to go to, out to nature, for example, and sometime having a place to meditate where there is a nice view can be very supportive of meditation practice. Being in a quiet place, not a loud, noisy place could be very helpful. So he did recognize that, certain sensory stimulations were helpful for meditation, but to give us a good foundation to be able to see beyond it, not to become dependent upon it. And in our Western society, now we have, a lot of people have a lot of stimulation through their mind. That's the sixth sense in Buddhism. And the, trying to maybe develop a little bit more awareness of just, what is the nature of some of this sensory stimulation from the mind, for example. Some of us maybe we like to, we get a lot of stimulation out of planning the future. Some of us maybe going through the past, the good old days, right? The good old days, And when you really look at them, they aren't so good, actually. But they're old, but they aren't good. Or I think they're only so-called good because it's kind of reassuring. There is certain, to me, there is certain, oh yes, I was there, I did that. You know, there's a sense of self in there and a sense of certain kind of certainty or security in it. I mean, planning the future is a little bit more risky, you know. You can really develop a lot of fantasies about the future. But it's a little bit risky because usually it doesn't work. I was going to be, you know, really, really rich engineer one time, you know. Rich and famous engineer. That's when I was failing my engineering exams. And I could just fantasize that I could all pass and I'll be really famous and rich and be really successful and build all kinds of things. And then I see what it's really like when trying to build a kitchen. And then I'm glad I failed. Actually. You know, I recognize there's a tendency, I mean, I had this myself, that just to kind of blot out my mind. You know, just turn it off. Shut up. You know? I remember in my first meditation retreat in Sri Lanka, and I was in this little cell, you know, 6 feet by 3 feet or something, meditating, and this mind was just going on and on and on and on. It just wouldn't shut up. One time I just got so frustrated, I just said, "Ah, shut up." And it did. And then I got really lonely. Just for a minute, the mind stopped. Oh, where am I? Who am I? Quick, start thinking again. You know, with all that, even though all that thinking was, you know, was a bit of disturbance, at least I had something to identify with. And that's kind of the very source where the Buddha is saying that sense desire or sense stimulation is one of the outflows of selfhood. Because if you notice the process, you know, there's a seeing of an object. What is actually happening, the kind of very basic experience is there is a physical eye, there's an object, and there is the consciousness of it. And then a little voice says, "Hey, I see something." That's not reality. That's what we add on to it. The actual fact is there's just the physical eye, and then there is the object, and there is the consciousness. Something in the brain says, "Hey, there's something there." And then little voice, myself, my ego, says, "Ooh, I see that," with the assumption that when I see that, I now have control over it. I can hang on to it, or I can push it away. If it's dangerous, I push it away. If it's likable, I can hold on to it and keep it. And then the whole sense of self starts to come into it now. You know, it's like this, it reminds me of this, and pleasure and pain and all the associations come into it. That's all extra. The fact is, there's just the physical eye, you know, which sees form and color, and there's a registration in the mind. That's what every sentient being has. That human beings say, "Oh, I see, I like, I want, gimme." Greed. I mean, maybe some of the other animals also see that too. You know, they don't say I, because just by interpretation we say that animals don't have a self consciousness. They just, you know, just see something and it's food or it's danger. You know, if it's food you go for it. If it's danger, run away. Very basic. Rather than interpret, say, "Oh, I like that. I know all about this." But it can be this, if we don't understand it, it can become the source of the increase or the support of ego. You know, I see, therefore I know, therefore I like, therefore I can control. And then this dualistic relationship develops between the subject and the object. In one of the scriptures, somebody came to the Buddha and they said, "Can you give me a teaching very, very succinct?" And the Buddha said, "Okay." He said, "In the seeing, just the seeing. In the hearing, just the hearing. In the cognizing, just the cognizing. If you can be with that, then there's no arising of self and ego and all the complications that come around that. Just seeing." But easy to say, huh? Can you just see? And your mind, it just stops. Just just seeing. Not so easy, is it? Maybe if you have a little bit of focused attention on the breathing and the mind is quieter, sometime you can do that, just seeing. The mind doesn't move anymore. There's no thought of, I see, I like, I want, pleasure, pain. Just as a seeing, just a hearing. And doesn't go any further into a building of an I and all the associations around it. And then we recognize then what the whole nature of this process is then. You know, if we investigate a little bit further and can see maybe the roll-on effect, you know, I see, I like, I want, I can't have. Disappointment. Hey, don't believe in that story. Don't follow that story. Or I see, I like, I want, I got, and then it's gone. Oops. Dropped again. Disappointment again. Roy, it's a... I could write a Hollywood script, couldn't I? That's probably a Hollywood script for all the movies anyway. You know? Boy sees girl, fall in love, then they break up, and then... Or somebody, another boy sees the girl too, and then they fight over it. And But the Buddha is pointing out to us, and as a theme for mindfulness or awareness, the whole realm of the senses, being able to see these sense impressions and what they do to us. And if you put yourself into the observing of it, what happens is we find that we can kind of dismantle it. We don't become part of the whole automatic process anymore. If you become the observer, then we aren't pulled into the whole process. We aren't the activator or the initiator of all this. We're just the observer of it. And say, oh, interesting. I can see now the mind is automatic pilot. You know, see, like, want. Can't get. Okay. How about the next story? Okay. See, want, like, can't have. Gone away or something. But we see that directly, this is the beginning of wisdom now. We've actually understood the whole process. And then this dispassion, this disenchantment sets in, and there's another kind of experience. Now we have a pleasure, which is now peace, rather than excitement. You know, most of the people are fooled by the excitement that comes from the sense stimulation. Say, oh yes, very fascinating, very exciting. But it's not very peaceful, it's not very cool, not very relaxing, not very deeply calming or peaceful. It's based upon stimulation all the time. And then when you get to be maybe about 60, it's hard work. Teacher in Bengal, actually, eastern India, and she was quite well known in some circles in the West. She had quite a few Western disciples, and one of these Westerners came to her and said, "You know, to be enlightened, you know, must be really boring, you know, because you just sit there in peace all the time. Really boring, isn't it?" She said, "Exactly the opposite." She said, "You guys, you know, you who don't see this, your life is really boring," she said. "Because when you can really see the true nature of things, that's reality. Everything is crystal clear and alive constantly, a constantly moving process, constantly alive," she said. That's the real picture. That's real aliveness. You know? And what you're seeing is just your own memories, your own perceptions, your own biases. She said, "That's really boring. You know, because people are really boring, actually. They only see the same things over and over again. They think it's exciting and they think it's real, but it's just the same old stuff, same old story." Does that sound familiar? Yes. Okay, each time I give it a little bit of a different twist, you know, but still the same old story. But she was saying, when you're free of that, you're just awake to the present, ever-changing present moment all the time. Constantly changing, constantly alive. And that's real clarity, and that's real aliveness, not being with the same boring story all the time. So this man who asked the question was a psychologist, actually. He got a different perception of meditation. So relinquishment, in a way, translating it that way, was it's more like the result of seeing the real nature of sensory stimulation, the whole sense processes, and then a certain relinquishment sets in. On the other side of it, relinquishment, or nekama, is one of the right aspirations in the Eightfold Path. In the Eightfold Path, you know, right aspiration, sama sankappa, there's three of them, three right aspirations towards harmlessness, ahimsa, towards non-cruelty, and then towards this nekama, relinquishment. So the Buddha's pointing out that's the right attitude. You know, it's not about accumulating more things. You know, we can say sometimes in the spiritual path, depending upon what level we're at, it can be helpful to accumulate, you know, developing like these 10 paramitas, these 10 qualities that lead to Buddhahood. You know, cultivate them, develop them. But if we still have that attitude that I'm getting it, I'm getting it, I'm holding on to it, I'm accumulating it, it's just feeding the ego again. But with the right attitude, behind everything there is this fundamental attitude of relinquishment. Okay, we put some effort into cultivating these qualities, but it's about letting go of them too. Once they get cultivated and developed, we don't need to hold on to them anymore. We don't need to build an ego around them. They become part of our way of being then. You can say, and the only way that they're really going to be fully manifest and developed in their ultimate is when there's no self trying to contain them, trying to hold on to them, trying to own them. And if we try and own something like generosity, I'm so generous, you can't be, because your sense of I is obstructing that openness then. If you're trying to hold on to relinquishment, then your sense of self is obstructing the real practice of relinquishment. It begins to function by itself. And the only really fulfillment of it is when the self is out of the picture. In the beginning, perhaps we need to initiate it or get it going, but then once it gets cultivated, it begins to have a power of itself, of its own then, beyond my limiting of it. And it's like the practice of mindfulness or awareness. You know, I use the word mindfulness, make a little play on the word, that when it gets developed, it's full presence of mind, you know, mindfulness. And it can only be mind can only be fully present when you, or yourself, is not obstructing the view. You got to step out of the way, you have to step out of the picture to have fullness of mind. If there's a certain degree of awareness there, and you say, I'm being aware, I'm being mindful, you've clouded it over, you've obstructed it with your eye, with yourself. And in the beginning, perhaps we have to, you know, remind ourselves, be mindful, be aware, I'm being aware. But you know, then after a while, we begin to relinquish it, relinquish our control of it, and then it begins to gain a power of its own then. And then it becomes full presence of mind without me doing anything about it. And the same with all of these qualities that lead to Buddhahood. I mean, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but, you know, when they get really fully developed, they kind of just, you know, they kind of fill out our being, and our sense of self gets pushed out of the picture. Then this Buddhahood is there. But if we're still holding on to it, it's still identifying with it, you know, I've got generosity, I've got morality, I've got relinquishment. Whoops. You got all these qualities, but you're not Buddha. You're still yourself. So is a helpful attitude or a right attitude, a relinquishment in the background, keep reminding ourselves, even though we get, you know, we can develop or we can recognize these qualities, these positive qualities, but remember, oops, don't hang on to it. Don't identify with it. You're going to turn it into an ego support. And the right attitude is relinquishment. It starts to develop and manifest and then step off, step back, relinquish it. And then we have the right attitude for the development of all the other factors of the Eightfold Path. So it starts off with a practical way. A practical relinquishment has to do with beyond sensuality or beyond the sense desires. And we understand how these sense impressions work and how they stir up desire, you know, which is in a way is like an artificial energy. You know, it's not going to be there all the time. It's going to disappoint us. It's like very temporary and fragile. We withdraw our energy from that and put it into, you know, clarity and being able to observe more clearly the understanding of the whole process. And then this kind of disenchantment, dispassion begins to set in, and we realize a different level of pleasure, if you like, the pleasure of relinquishment, of nibbana, of the letting go of any identification with the ego. So it sounds like a possibility, huh? Takes a bit of work maybe, but a possibility, something to work on for the next week, for the next theme. So I will pause there this evening.